In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be looking at the issue of college tuition and why it is the cost of college education has been going up, it seems, for just about as long as anybody can remember. And as far as anybody knows, we expect that trend to continue into the future, unless, of course, some things change. We'll be talking this morning with Ronald Ehrenberg. He's professor of industrial and labor relations and economics at Cornell University. He's also director of the Cornell Higher Education Research Institute. And he's authored a book that we'll be talking about. The title of his book is Tuition Rising, Why College Costs So Much. This is a book that really concentrates on tuition at this country's elite private universities, places like Yale and Harvard and Cornell and Dartmouth, and why it is that costs at those universities continue to go up. But I'm sure that some of the issues that apply to places like Harvard and Dartmouth and Cornell certainly apply to the University of Illinois and other public universities. There are some significant differences we'll talk about, but we'll see if we can talk about some of the larger factors as well. And questions, of course, are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana is 333-9455. We also have toll-free line good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. You match the numbers with the letters on the phone. You get WILL, which may or may not make it easier, 333-WILL, and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Those are the numbers. Professor Ehrenberg, hello.
Yes, hello, David. Good to speak to you.
Glad to have you with us this morning. Just to talk about some numbers right at the beginning, maybe we could just talk a little bit about the averages now, both for private and public universities. Generally speaking now, we look at the ranges. How much does it cost now to go to college in the United States?
Well, at the selected private universities, when you add in room and board and living expenses, you're talking about well over $35,000 a year. And at the public universities, you're probably talking more in the range of $12,000 to $20,000 a year.
Yeah, I think just for comparison basis, here at the University of Illinois, a tuition increase has been proposed. So that would mean that new students coming to the U of I would pay $1,000 more for tuition over the next 2 years. The tuition would go up by $500 each of the next 2 years. So that would mean that for all students at Urbana next year, the in-state undergraduate tuition would be $3,910, and the new students would pay more. Then the second increment would be added in the fall of 2002.
So the Illinois figure does not include room and board and expenses.
Right.
That's right. And the strategy of increasing tuition for new students but not for existing students is a strategy that has been practiced elsewhere because it doesn't irritate the people who are already there.
It seems to me that as I look at some of the figures in your book, for example, you have some a chart here that looks at tuition and fees at Cornell going back to 1965. Now, apparently, people who have looked at this would say that tuition has continued to grow faster than the cost of living for something like the last 100 years. But here you have some figures going back to 1965, and it does seem that between 1965 and 1980, it was relatively stable, but that in 1980, you begin to see a very steady climb in the cost between 80 and
now. What has happened is tuition has gone up by more than the rate of inflation, on average by 2 to 3% a year, going back at least to the start of the previous century. During most of the time, however, family incomes were going up also, and they were going up faster than inflation, so that tuition as a share of family income was not rising. But what happened in the United States was that during the decade of the 80s, income did not go up as fast as inflation. So as a result, if tuition was going up faster than inflation, income was going up less than inflation, which meant that people's real incomes were actually declining, then tuition relative to family incomes were increasing. And that occurred throughout the whole decade of the 80s. By the time we got to the early 90s, income started to rise again. But as I say in the book, by then the damage had been done, because a selective private education such as Cornell, which was 26% of the average family income at the start of the 80s, by the time we got to the early 90s, was 47 or 48%. Mm-hmm. And so people became much more concerned about the cost of college.
Another striking fact is something that you point out. While this might not last, it is the case and has been the case for some time now that even as the costs continue to go up, so does the number of students seeking admission.
That's absolutely correct. And I think that is probably the most important factor which allows the institutions to continue to raise their tuition so rapidly. It is not the case that as our price goes up, fewer students want to attend our institutions. In fact, quite the contrary, it is the fact that more and more students want to attend the institution, and these are the very best students in our nation, that gives the institutions the freedom to continue raising tuition by more than inflation.
You look at a number of factors that go into the mix and to help answer this question, why it is that costs have gone up at these selective private universities. And again, as I'd said, I'm certain that many of these things apply to public universities, big ones like the University of Illinois and others. But generally speaking, we can talk about some of these things in detail, though. I think you would argue that these selective private universities have done a rather poor job at controlling their costs, and that public universities like this one have done rather better. What's the big difference?
Well, the big difference, okay, every institution wants to be as good as it can. And what being good means depends upon the objective of the institution. It may be very different at a large institution which has a mission to serve a large number of students in the state than it is from a smaller private institution. But the major difference is that in the public institutions, there is someone who puts a hand on and says, wait a minute, you can't do that. And the someone who does that basically is the political process and state government, because the state government controls the appropriation to the university. And if the state government doesn't do it directly, at least indirectly, it often controls the tuition level. So you still can spend more if you can get more research grants and you can raise more endowment and get more annual giving, but you don't have the luxury of saying, I want to increase my tuition and I will, which the selective private institutions have.
Well, here at the University of Illinois, as you point out, the University of Illinois is it's accountable to the trustees, it's accountable to the General Assembly, ultimately it's accountable to the people of the state of Illinois. But I would also imagine that Cornell and Harvard and Yale, those places, at the very least, they are accountable to their trustees, to their alums, and maybe in some sense to the people of their states, even though they're private institutions.
Well, they certainly are, but the dilemma is that there isn't that type of absolute check which state government puts on. And so at the private institutions, the trustees would like the institutions to be as good as possible. Many of them, of course, are successful business people who are used to holding down costs. But if the president comes and says, I need money to do this or I need money to do that to make the institution even better, they're likely to swallow and go along. Now, why does the president always come to them and ask for more money? Why doesn't the president try to aggressively cut cost and get better by substitution rather than by spending money? I think that has a lot to do with the system of shared governance that exists at these universities. And that is to say, the faculty has an enormous amount of influence, and it's very, very difficult for a president or a provost to govern and to lead the institution without the support of the faculty. Now, if you're in a public institution and the state says cut, the president and the provost swallow and they make the cuts. The faculty is angry, but they blame the state. They don't blame the president or the provost. If at a private university, the president or the provost tries to do the same thing, then the faculty will blame that leader for not making a strong enough case to the trustees. And since it's impossible to govern without the support of the faculty, because the faculty has such a crucial role in many decisions, it's easier for the presidents of the selective privates to concentrate on getting more resources and not to worry about making hard internal decisions.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Ronald Ehrenberg, is professor of industrial and labor relations and economics at Cornell University. He's also director of the Cornell Higher Education Research Institute and is the author of a book titled Tuition Rising, Why College Costs So Much. It's published by the Harvard University Press. And as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, does look at primarily at the cost of college for the selective private universities like his, Cornell, and also other places like Dartmouth and Yale and Harvard. But I'm sure that some of the things we're talking about here do apply also to large public institutions like University of Illinois. Questions welcome, 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. As you say, I think all universities want to be the best they can, and quality of faculty is important. They like to have individuals who are prominent in their fields, people who win things like Nobel Prizes, if possible, or other sorts of recognition. And increasingly, colleges and universities have also had to compete with the private sector that in some fields might be able to pay more and lure faculty away. Also, there is some poaching, I'm sure, that goes on between institutions. If another institution is able to offer more, they may try to hire faculty away. For the colleges and universities that you're talking about, to what sort of role does faculty salaries and the demand to pay a certain level of salary, how does that contribute to the rising cost?
That's important, although I have to preface my remarks by saying that over long periods of time, faculty salaries have just kept up with the salary of average college graduates in the United States. Faculty salaries have actually declined relative to the salaries of other highly educated people who go into professions such as law and medicine and business. So I hope that nobody who is listening comes to the conclusion that we're trying to bash faculty. So the basic dilemma is the following. At least at the private institutions, tuition, for the most part, and faculty salaries basically balance. Those are the two main discretionary items in the university budget. And if you want to give your faculty salary increases, which are the same as the salary increases in the rest of the economy, which typically are going up at rates greater than inflation, because except for the decade of the 80s, our real incomes have been increasing, you have to increase tuition by more than inflation. And you say, why is that? Well, the answer is that at these institutions, the productivity of faculty members, at least in terms of the number of students that they teach each year, does not go up because the institutions believe that trying to keep class size small is essential on average for high-quality undergraduate education.
I'm interested in talking about the difference between the actual cost of education and what students pay, because the tuition that students pay doesn't cover the entire cost. And I'm interested in just what that spread is, and
right,
then where the other input comes.
Yeah, I mean that's a really excellent point. What we want to say is that even the people who pay the full tuitions at the selective private universities are not paying anywhere near the cost of their education. And the reason for that is that the institutions get some revenue in the form of income from their endowments. They get annual giving from alumni. And then there is the whole alumni and other people. And then there is the whole value of all of the buildings in which the students are educated, which have been provided to the students typically through previous giving by people or by previous giving by government. And of course, at the University of Illinois and other public institutions, the subsidy is equally as large because here we have direct state support as well.
We have a caller to bring into the conversation. Let's do that. They're in Champaign on line one. Hello.
Yes, my question, you made a comment that colleges, private and, of course, public colleges, want to be the best that they can be, and I guess they utilize their resources in a manner to achieve that end. What do you mean? That's a pretty amorphous term to me, or ambiguous. What do you mean they want to be the best that they can be in undergraduate education, in graduate education, in teaching, in research, in getting star faculty?
Well, you've hit upon
to teach in place of star faculty. There's a big dispute here at the University of Illinois in undergraduate education that there are star faculty here, but they do basically research, and the undergraduates in large classes are taught primarily by teaching assistants or adjuncts.
You've hit upon a basic problem and part of the dilemma, and that is when you have a nonprofit organization such as a university, there's no single objective, but rather we want to be, every unit wants to be as good as it can. So the people concerned about undergraduate education want to have more resources for undergraduate education. The athletic department wants to have better athletic facilities, not only for varsity sports, but for intramural sports and recreational users. The student activities, the people in charge of student activities want to have more space for different performance groups to perform. The resident halls want to have more students and administrative support in there to make their programs better. Any dimension that you can think about, we find ways to spend money on to make ourselves look better than our competitors.
Does that, caller, does that get at your question?
Yeah, but does that necessarily translate into quality in the true sense of the word, or just, you know, abstract aspirations that necessarily don't translate into the best quality?
No, you're absolutely correct. And I'll tell you, part of the problem, and we can sort of jump to this, goes to how do students decide what the quality of the academic institution is. If you're an undergraduate student and you're trying to decide where to go to school, how do you decide? Well, you start going to look at college guidebooks, and pretty soon you come to U.S. News and World Report's rankings, which have become the most popular college guide, as it would be. U.S. News and World Report gives specific numerical rankings to institutions, but they are based to a large extent on the characteristics of the students who go to the institution, how much money the institution spends educating the students, and the extent to which alumni support the institution. So there is constant pressure on the institutions to spend more money if you want to look good in these U.S. News and World Report rankings. And as you point out, spending money does not necessarily translate into better quality education.
All right. Thank you, sir.
All right, thanks. Well, let me. I hope we're not putting too fine a point on this, but let me ask the direct question. Then, do you think that at the institutions that you have looked at, that they have been spending? You have a university. You've got to have classrooms. You've got to have libraries. You've got to have laboratories. You have to have the essential things that are involved in delivering the education. Then there are other things that are nice, but maybe not essential. Really nice dormitories, athletic facilities, recreational facilities, other sorts of things that perhaps enhance the appearance and the image, but aren't essential to delivering the essential product, which is the education to students. Do you think that at the universities you've looked at, that the priorities here are out of balance?
Well, the goal of the institution is to be as good as it can, and in order to be as good as you can, you have to attract the best possible students, because the students are what, along with the faculty, are what make the institution. If we have bright students, faculty will want to be at the institution, and if we have good faculty, students will want to be at the institution. But unfortunately, students seem to be valuing other things these days besides simply the quality of the faculty. And it's not enough to have dormitories. We now have to have residential living units. We can't have dormitory rooms. We have to have suites and apartments. It's not enough for Cornell to have a gym. We better have a fitness center for our students, because Northwestern has a fitness center. And so basically the institutions are competing with each other and ratcheting up expenditures for areas which really, as you point out, are not directly essential to the educational experience.
Mm. Well, I'd find this really interesting. I guess my thought would have been, my expectation would have been, that if an individual was fortunate enough to have the means and the ability to be admitted to Harvard or Yale or Dartmouth or Cornell, that it wouldn't, that you wouldn't do that kind of minute examination, or I guess I wouldn't expect that there would be that much difference between places when you get on that level of private university.
Well, there actually is substantial difference, and the reason there is substantial difference is that these institutions vary greatly in endowment wealth. And I had some examples in the book, and here I was talking about the 1997-98 academic year, but if you came forward today, the differences would be even greater. And that is, Princeton received more each year in endowment income per student than either the University of Pennsylvania, Duke, or Cornell did in tuition plus endowment income. And so when you add in Princeton's tuition to its endowment income, they have close to double the resources that these other selective private universities have to try to do things to attract students. They can have smaller classes. They can have more generous financial aid packages. They can have better facilities. They can pay higher, have higher paid faculty. Mm. So among the set of selected private institutions, all are very fortunate, but there is a wide disparity in resources, and everyone is trying to get more resources to improve its position relative to the competitor institutions.
I think that's really interesting, because when you look at the figures that you present, the biggest endowment of all these institutions, at least at this point, where as of June 30, 1997, was Harvard. They were getting close to $11 billion, which was the number one, certainly more than Princeton, which was down at a measly $4.9 billion. And yet Princeton's putting, and I guess I can only assume it's because we have fewer students, they're
right,
putting
Princeton,
more money behind
Princeton
each student.
It's a much smaller institution. It's basically a liberal arts college with graduate students and a school of public and international affairs. There's no medical school. There's no business school. There's no law school. And because there's so many fewer students, its endowment per student is larger. But to give you an idea of how rapidly things can change, if we come forward now and ask what happened between July of 1999 and July of 2000, Harvard's endowment went up by $4.8 billion, which is larger than the endowments, the total of endowments, but all but about 10 colleges and universities nationwide. Another way of saying that is that if you transfer what did the increase in Harvard's endowment mean in terms of the amount of income that they had available to spend on each of their students in a year, they had over $10,000 more income per student that they could spend because of the increased value of their endowment. So you can sort of see how the rich keep getting richer.
We are a little past the midpoint. Our guest is Ronald Ehrenberg. He's professor of industrial and labor relations and economics at Cornell University. And if you're interested in reading up on this topic, the title of the book we have been talking about here is Tuition Rising, Why College Costs So Much. It's published by the Harvard University Press and does, as I've mentioned, concentrate on why does the cost have gone up so much at the selective private universities. Phone numbers here, we have a couple of people we'll get right to. The phone numbers here, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Our next caller is in Savoy, and it's line one. Hello.
Hey, man. This is very interesting, and I think the guest has described some clarifications, but I want to make a statement and ask a couple quick questions. The basic statement is, I smell a rat somewhere. This has just gone too high. The inflationary aspects, the increased costs, the cost of textbooks, somehow there's something egregious going on. Now, that's my statement. Now, the questions are, why aren't some of these huge endowments of monies being used to make it cheaper for regular families' children to go to these colleges? Where is all this money going, really?
Now, the answer is that a lot of the money does go to make things cheaper because what you see the tuition level, or we add in room and board, and I say it's going to cost $35,000 a year, you can think of that as the posted price. But there are substantial discounts in the form of grant aid that comes from federal and state governments and primarily from the institutions themselves now. And at least at many of the selected private institutions, the grant aid is based almost solely on the financial need of the applicant. So at an institution such as Cornell, for example, in the private part of our university, we will have roughly 50% of our students receiving financial aid. And of that 50%, some of them are just receiving government grants, truly low-income students, or loans with reduced interest rates. But about 35% of them are receiving grants from the university, and the average grant is probably in the range of $12,000 to $15,000.
But some of my friends they get $1,000, but the tuition is $8,000, $10,000, $12,000. So what if 50% of the students are getting $1,000 aid? That's
okay, so you're talking about the public institutions where there is much less grant aid available. And I guess the concern that you have is that, on average, the tuition after aid is higher than you would like it to be at these institutions. But what I think we have to remember is that the tuition is not what it costs the university to produce the education. The tuition is only a share of it. And at many of these institutions, state appropriations have not been growing over time. In fact, in the late 80s to the mid-90s, the average public institution by the end of the period received 10% less from state government in real terms than it did before. And so part of the reason that tuition has been increasing in the public institutions is that the states have not kept up their funding of the institutions sufficiently to meet the needs of the institutions.
Well, saw something in a financial newspaper a few months ago that made it sound like the cost at universities is humongously bigger than the rest of costs around the country.
Well, I'm not sure that's true. I mean, inflation has gone up. Okay, the cost of a college education has gone up relative to the cost of many other things. But I think when we another point we have to make is that when we look at the level or the rate of increase in tuition at colleges and universities, we don't take account of the quality changes that are occurring in figuring out what the inflation rate is. And a college experience today at many places is very, very different than a college experience even 10 years ago at the same places. For example, our campuses and most campuses now are completely wired to use the Internet, which means that students don't stand online to register, but they register from their homes or their dorm rooms. They can speak to professors whenever they want by sending them email messages. They don't wait for office hours. They can speak to people any place in the world, for example. And these are costs which the university has to bear, which somehow it has to recoup.
I appreciate the comments of the caller, and the lines are full here, and I want to try to get to the other callers. I guess I do want to get back to one question that he raised, and perhaps it's something that we could debate for a long, long time. I'm looking here at an article about the proposed tuition increases here at University of Illinois that appeared in our local paper in December, and it quotes an official, Chester Gardner, who was interim vice president for academic affairs, and I don't know if he still holds that position, but at any rate, Mr. Gardner was talking about the tax increase, and he was quoted as saying, even at $5,000 plus, University of Illinois tuition would still be a, quote, remarkable bargain, he said. The average U of I graduate can expect to earn $600,000 more over a lifetime than the average college graduate. And I assume that a degree from Harvard still and Cornell and Dartmouth still means something, and that those folks would expect to see some return on their investment. I guess it still gets back though to the big question: is it really worth it?
Well, that's an interesting question. Here are some facts. Fact number one: the return to attending college in general has been increasing. And that college graduates today earn considerably more than high school graduates relative to what a comparison was 10 or 20 years ago. The second fact is which college you go to matter. And there have been a number of studies, including several that I have co-authored, which showed that if you go to a selective private college or university, your earnings, you will do better than if you go anyplace else. But the second place, best place to go, is to a selective a public research institution, and that's where I would presume the man that you were speaking about got his numbers from.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, there are faculty members right at your university who do research on this topic.
Well, let us continue talking with people who are listening. We'll go next to someone in Champaign. This is line two. Hello.
Hi there.
Yes.
When we originally approached this issue, we kind of put it in this dichotomy between public and private institutions. And then you broached the subject of scale and how the scale of an institution can impact the increase in the cost of attending that school. And have you looked at different kinds of private institutions, say, compared the larger institutions that are also major research, have major research facilities and do graduate education, and then compared those to maybe smaller private institutions, which generally focus on undergraduate education? Is there a significant difference in the rate of increase in cost at those kinds of schools?
There's no, fortunately or unfortunately, depending upon your perspective, there's no difference at all. It's just that the institutions use the money for different things. At the selective private institutions, the liberal arts colleges, the money is poured into maintaining and enhancing the undergraduate program, whereas at the selective private universities, there are many other things that we do.
Okay, thank you.
All right, let's go to another caller. This will be Bloomington, and it's line number four. Hello.
Yes, hi. I was wondering, why some of the select wealthy institutions have devoted resources away from what I would consider quality education. My example specifically comes from Cornell a few years ago. I know of a situation where students in a particular college did not encounter in their own college classes that were smaller than 75 in 4 years of undergraduate education. And I was wondering why a school like Cornell, with tuitions like that, can't or chooses not to hire more faculty. And we're not talking about going to very small class sizes. We're talking about a situation where in the college of the students that the student is in, the student can't get classes that are even what at a public institution would be considered reasonable.
Right. I'm not in the Cornell administration anymore. I'm a faculty member, so this will be a completely personal answer, not an institutional answer. Cornell works very, very hard to have a mix of small and large classes. So, for example, in the first year, all students take freshman writing courses, which are taught in classes of 15 to 20 students. Similarly, language courses and introductory calculus classes, which used to be large classes, are now taught in very, very small sections. But the economics of large research universities makes it inevitable that there will be large classes with teaching assistants in smaller sections for some courses. And then the other thing that has happened to Cornell is, I don't know which college you were talking about, but Cornell is half a public institution. We have a set of colleges which are called statutory colleges. The university runs them under a state statute by a contract with New York State, and that's the College of Industrial and Labor Relations, the College of Human Ecology, and the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences. And the budgets of these colleges have been slashed drastically over the last 15 or 20 years by the state. We probably get about 20% less per student in state support in real terms than we did in 1988. So in these colleges, the class sizes have crept up.
Now, this was a College of Engineering, and I was wondering whether it was that the faculty, not wanting to dilute the quality of their faculty, chose not to hire or pushed not to hire more faculty.
No, there are many, many bright people out there who the university would profit by having and coming and being on the faculty, but we simply can't afford, or the college can simply not afford to hire more. I'm surprised by the numbers you've told me, because the college has, you know, worked hard, as I said, to put in a small calculus classes for people and other things.
Yeah, no, I know. I know this for a fact. I said I'm a Cornell graduate myself, this was my son who experienced this in 4 years. Didn't have a class. He went in College of Arts and Sciences, had small classes, but in engineering there was nothing that he took that was
right.
That was small.
Well, there are internal resource allocation questions as to who gets what money, and I'm sure the dean of the College of Engineering would argue that he should get more resources so his college could have more small classes.
Well, thanks very much.
All right, thanks for the call. Other questions, comments are welcome. We have a little less than 10 minutes in this hour of Focus 580. Our guest is Ron Ehrenberg. He's professor of industrial and labor relations and economics at Cornell University. His book, Tuition Rising, Why College Costs So Much, is published by the Harvard University Press. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. It's the number if you'd like to call in toll-free, 800-222-9455. You talked about the fact that one of the things that's driving up the costs is the fact that these institutions are competing for students, competing with one another, and that means they not only want to put money behind salaries, for example, so they can have prestigious faculties and state-of-the-art laboratories, but also other sorts of things that students want to have, like nice places to live and places to work out and so forth. We also talked about the fact that in spite of the increase in tuition, that the numbers of people who are applying to places like this continues to go up. But I wonder what happens, and does this problem become more severe if we get to the point where we don't have this steady increase in applicants? I would think that then these institutions would might well become increasingly desperate as they compete for a shrinking population of new students.
Well, I mean, ultimately, competition is the thing that will help to hold the prices down. And one of the things that I argue in the book is that what we need to do as a society is better fund our public institutions to make them more attractive to students. And that's important not only because it will help to keep the price of the selective privates down, but it's important because over 80% of our nation's students are educated in public institutions. And so paradoxically, someone from Cornell is arguing that we should worry much more about what's going on in the public institutions than we should about what's going on in these selective private institutions.
Well, that does indeed raise the question of why it is that we as the public should care at all what it costs to go to Cornell or Yale or Harvard.
Yeah, well, the argument that I like to make goes something like this. I don't care about wealthy people spending millions of dollars on houses and hundreds of thousand dollars on luxurious cars as long as I don't have to pay for it. And that's the reason why currently in our federal tax system, you are not allowed to take interest deductions for vacation homes. On the other hand, the public, you and I and all individuals, does subsidize these selective private institutions, and we select them, subsidize them in a wide number of ways. The contributions that alumni make are deductible under federal and state income tax laws. So are the contributions that they get from corporations. The institutions pay no income taxes on endowment earnings. The property that they use for educational purposes is tax exempt, and much of their borrowing is done at tax exempt interest rates. And so what this means is there's a large amount of tax revenue that federal and state governments are not collecting because of these institutions, and that means either that the rest of us as individuals have to make it up, or alternatively, that we get poorer public services for other things. So these institutions, because of these subsidies, have to show that they're working in the public interest.
We have two callers. We'll try to get them in. First, in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Oh, hi there.
Yes.
I'm not sure if you've already mentioned something. I didn't catch the whole show, but here at the U of I, we have a move to unionize graduate assistants who teach an increasingly large portion of classes on campus. And, you know, when you're speaking about the cost of higher education, obviously the labor needed to educate students is a big part of that total cost. So I just wondered if you could say something about there's movements across the country for teaching assistants to unionize, and I wondered if, you know, you have any thoughts on that as part of the cost of education total.
Yeah, well, the movements to unionize occur primarily when students feel that they are being exploited. When I was a graduate student in the late 1960s, there were wonderful jobs waiting for all of us, and our responsibilities in terms of teaching were very, very minimal. Now, at many universities, students do not see wonderful jobs out there, and they often are teaching, you know, 12, 15 hours a week. So the teaching, rather than becoming an educational experience for them, becomes really work, which hinders their degree progress. There also are concerns about whether or not graduate students are provided health insurance. At my institution, they are, but at many institutions, they are not. And that's a difficult financial position to be in. So it may be that there will be increased unionization of graduate students, and that may lead to some increase in the cost of higher education, but it may be something that's a fair thing to do.
Right, and I wonder if it will actually increase education or if we're missing the fact that it's the increased work done by graduate assistants is keeping the cost of education down, and so maybe it's okay. You know, maybe those graduate students deserve a little more of that pie. That's just my two cents, and I'll thank you for your response.
You're welcome.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. Well, we are going to have to leave it at that point. With our apologies here to someone we can't take, but we're simply at the end of the time. We want to say to you, Professor Ehrenberg, thanks very much for talking with us today.
Well, it's been my great pleasure to do so, and if I can just put in a plug, if anybody wants to know more about my book, they can just log on to the Amazon.com or the BarnesandNoble.com or the Borders.com webpage, and they will find sort of descriptions of it as well as some reviews.
Very good. Our guest, Ron Ehrenberg, he's professor of industrial and labor relations and economics at Cornell, and his book is titled Tuition Rising, Why College Costs So Much. It's published by the Harvard University Press.